Yes, so Rashi says that his wife goes out with him. V'chimi ichnisa shetesei. So he says, who brought her in the first place that she has to go out? Because clearly that's what the pasuk seems to be talking about. With regard to the Eved, the going out is the going out of slavery. Elamaket akosav, but rather we can deduce, the pasuk is telling us, we could deduce, shakona Eved Ivri, that one who purchases an Eved Ivri, chayav bimzonos ishto uvanov, becomes responsible for the upkeep, maintenance of his wife and children. So that's what she goes out with him is referring to, a different aspect of, not that she's a slave, but she gets the benefit of the slave without the obligation. The benefit is that the upkeep, the slave gets room and board. But, or the servant, as we're saying. Now we're learning something new. That if he's married, then the obligation to support his family falls upon the master. So the pasuk is saying that if he's a married man, so at the end of 6 years, when he goes free, v'yatza ishto imo, his wife goes out too. Well, what does she go out from? She goes out from that benefit. She stops collecting her check to pay for her and her children's upkeep. The question that's being raised is, why does the pasuk have to tell me that after 6 years he doesn't have to support the wife anymore? Isn't that obvious? The only reason that he did support her, had to support her, was because the husband was working for him. The answer is that that's the purpose of the pasuk over here is to tell us that he has to support him, but it's telling us, it's choosing to communicate that to us by telling us when the obligation ends. So I can infer from the fact that it terminates that there was an obligation to support her in the first place. But not that there was a thought, that there was a hava mina, so to speak, that I might have thought that he has to continue to support her even after. It's a interesting literary mechanism. That is to say that if he's married, so his wife goes out with him, is the way the Torah chooses to tell us that she was really, in one way or another, involved in the situation in the first place. How so? That the master had to support her, and of course, that obligation terminates at that point also. Question we're dealing with is, why not use the straightforward approach? Why does the Torah choose to convey this to us by the removal, that by telling us when it's removed? The real point is to tell us that, in fact, it does come into play. Why didn't it tell us this directly? Point is that the master is only obligated to support the wife and child, the family, it mentions the child, the family, when the family was present at the time he purchased the Eved. So it's clear that he's assuming that responsibility. But if he was not married at that time, and then he wants to get married, then the obligation wouldn't be upon the master. I'll just offer an opinion, a possibility, as to why the Torah chose to express it that way. Because I think the phrase, v'yotza ishto imo, has significance. His wife should go out imo with him. And that is to say, it's reaffirming the significance of the integrity of the marriage. So that too must be taken into consideration. In order to have such an institution, what effect will it have on the marriage? That the man should lose his freedom up to a point, and now come under the jurisdiction of the master. So that's a problem. So you might think, well, perhaps this only applies to single men. Torah says no, that it applies to married men as well, but it chooses to express the idea that the master is responsible for the upkeep in this manner. The result of this is v'yotza ishto imo, that when she goes out, she'll still be imo, she'll still be with him. For were that not the case, it could very well lead to a breakup of the marriage. So perhaps the Torah chooses to express it this way, but because this way it's expressing the whole philosophy behind it. That rahmana, the Torah is referred to as rahmana, mercy. Everything is done with mercy. That even though the person committed a crime and it's important to pay back the debt and that's why he's being sold, you see a discrepancy there. A difference between the Torah's system, how the Torah operates, and take American jurisprudence or other systems, where essentially the person commits a crime, does the time. And what happens to his wife, what happens to his children in the meantime? Well, it's not their fault. But, and I understand, the system can't get involved in that kind of thing. Can't say, well, since you have a family, you don't go to jail. Maybe it's taken into consideration at a certain level to reduce the sentence or whatever, maybe a certain amount, but it's very minimal. You're not going to have two systems that only those who don't have families to support, they go to jail. And those who do have families don't go to jail. It doesn't work that way. But here you see that the Torah took into consideration all the consequences. That it's true that he committed a crime and he has to work and pay it off. But it recognized that in establishing the institution of Eved Ivri, it could have a very bad impact upon the marriage. It could destroy the marriage. Because what's going to happen to her? Who's going to support her? Well, once the husband doesn't support her anymore, that's it. The marriage is seriously jeopardized. Doesn't have to end up in divorce, but it could end up in divorce. Or if it doesn't end up in divorce, it could create a serious breach between the two of them. And she'll harbor resentment. She may have to go out and do menial work. So Rachmana, the Torah, in terms of mercy and compassion, created the obligation upon the master. So that to say, that removes this strain, this stress, and the upkeep of the wife and children is being afforded by the master. So that will keep the marriage together. So she goes out together with him. That as a result of the 6-year term of being an Eved, the marriage remains intact. We're continuing now with the study of the Eved Ivri, the Jewish servant. And we've established that when someone purchases an Eved Ivri, he becomes responsible if the individual was married at the time. When he purchased him, he assumes responsibility for the support of his wife. And we learned that out through a statement which talks about the termination of that responsibility. So the Torah doesn't state that directly. It says that if he comes in alone, if he comes in single, he goes out single. We have to study what that means. What do you mean he goes out single? Does that mean to say that he can't get married during that period of time? That would be very difficult, because he's a Jew, and insofar as he's Jewish, he has his full rights, his freedoms. If he marries a woman, she becomes his wife. So we don't know exactly what that part means, that if he goes in alone, he goes out alone, but we will find out soon. It's an interesting pasuk, the way it's structured. The second part says, "Mbal Ishahu," that if he's married, the Yatsa Ishto Imo, his wife goes out with him. Now, that can only be understood from the standpoint of the Torah Shebal Peh. What does it mean, she goes out with him? It can't mean that she goes into freedom, because she wasn't enslaved in the first place. If the husband becomes a servant or an Eved Ivri, a slave, whatever term you want to use, it doesn't affect the status of the wife. So, again, the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral law teaches us that she goes out from the responsibility. That is to say that the master had the responsibility of supporting her, which he assumed when he purchased the Eved, and now that terminates. So from this we can deduce, from the termination of the obligation, we deduce that the obligation existed in the first place. But the Torah chose to express it in the sense that she goes out with him, because in my opinion, it conveys the whole purpose behind it, that everything over here is from the standpoint of mercy. And that is to say that the Torah recognized that there would be difficult times in a person's life. That, I think, is the essential element of the institution of an Eved. We're not talking here about a violent criminal. That even if he stole, it's not talking about someone who's just a criminal by nature and who's violent. It means someone who's come upon difficult times, was driven to do so by the pressure of poverty. So that's what the two different types of Eved have in common. The one who sells himself is in a similar situation, except he doesn't take that step. He doesn't go beyond the boundary line and breaks the law and steals. So the Torah gives him an opportunity to have a period of time in which he can get back on his feet. The same seems to be the case with the one who stole. It's not a matter of violence. He stole and he doesn't have the money to pay back. So again, you see that it was poverty that induced him to do it. So in order to earn the money to repay the theft, he sold as an Eved. But the Torah is very, very concerned for the so-called rehabilitation, because there's a deeper reason. There's a deeper issue over here as to why he was forced into stealing. Why couldn't he find some way of gainful employment, of making a living? So the Torah over here is giving him an opportunity. That's why it's for a limited period of time. 6 years. After 6 years, he goes free. There are other ways in which he can purchase his freedom. But the whole institution in and of itself should not go beyond the 6 years. And the idea, the ideal, is to create an opportunity for an individual to either correct some mistakes or to develop or to mature, whatever it is that's necessary. To have some type of a framework in which he could put himself back together on his feet so that he could re-enter into the mainstream and be able to function as a normal human being. That's why, I believe, in my opinion, it mentions the Yatza Ishto Imo, that his wife goes out with him. And I think the key idea is Imo, that the objective is to maintain his situation, not to break up his marriage, because that's considered to be a positive aspect in his life. And if he were to become an Eved and have to leave, so to speak, abandon his wife, or, and even if he has children, and they would be unsupported, so that would put a tremendous strain. What's she supposed to do? What's she supposed to do? Go out and beg? So you're solving one person's problem and you're creating a problem for another person. Or it could lead to strains and maybe she'd divorce him. Actually, she can't divorce him, but she would want a divorce. It would put a strain on the marriage, so that wouldn't be a good idea. So here you see that the Torah took that into consideration. That there's an element of compassion in that, well, that's something which the master, if he's purchasing the Eved, has to bear in mind. That that's going to be one of his obligations to support the family. If that's the case, so the ideal is that he should go out. This should only be viewed as something temporary. And at the end, he should be rehabilitated, so to speak, and go out. And when he goes out, it should be Imo. He shouldn't have lost the family structure. Now, Pasuk Dalet, Im Adonav Yiten Lo Isha. If his master gives him a wife, the Yoldo Lo Bonim O Bonos, and she bears him sons or daughters, Ha'isha Viladeha, the woman and the children, Tia Ladoneha, shall belong to the master, Lehu Yetze Begapo, and he goes out alone. Rashi, Imadona Vita Lo Isha, Rashi's Mikan Sharashus Biad Rabo Limsorlo Shifcha Kananis Laholud Bimena Avadim. From here we learn out that the master has the power to give him a Shifcha Kananis, that is a Gentile woman who's a slave. Because as we said, there's two types of enslavement. There's the enslavement of a Gentile and the enslavement of a Jew. So the Gentile slave is more like a real slave in the sense that the master actually owns them as though they were property. So now we're talking about someone who has female Gentile slaves, purchased them, and he has the Jewish servant, the Eved Ivri, and now we're learning that he has the power to give this woman to him as a wife in order to bear children. That seems to be the whole purpose, is to bear children. And these children will then become slaves. That's what Rashi said. Now Rashi proceeds to explain, how do I know this? So Rashi says, "Oh, ain't no Elobi Israelis. How do you know? Maybe it's talking about a Jewish woman that the master gives him a Jewish woman for a wife." Talmud Lomar, the reason why you can't say that is because the pasuk itself says, "Ha'isha v'ilodeha tiyeh l'adoneha," that the woman and the children shall belong to her master. Ha'ayino medaber el b'knanis. This can only be speaking about a Gentile. Sharia ivriya afhi yotza b'shesh. Because if you want to say that it's talking about a Jewish servant, because you can have a female Jewish servant, obviously it's got to be talking about someone who's either some kind of slave. Because it can't be talking about an ordinary woman, because how can you say the master gives him an ordinary woman? The master can't give an ordinary woman. And there's no way, there's no sense that the master would retain ownership. So it's got to be two possibilities. Either it's an Amo Ivriya, which is the female equivalent of the Eved Ivri, or it's a Shifcha Kenanis, which is the female equivalent of the Gentile slave. So perhaps you'll say it means that he has an Amma, he has the servant, the female servant, and he gives her to the Eved. So Rashi is saying, you can't say that because the Pasuk says that the woman remains in the custody of the master. But if it's an Amma Evriya, if it's a Jewish servant, then she would go out at six. So then she doesn't remain behind. So therefore must be speaking about someone who remains behind beyond six, who remains permanently in the custody of the master, and that must be the Shifcha Kenanis. So that's what Rashi says. So now we've learned something new, that the master has the power to give the Eved, even against his will, it's not up to him, a female, a Gentile, who's a slave, as a wife, and they live together. She has children, and she and the children remain behind. 6 years comes up, he goes free, the children and the wife stay behind. Rashi Ambagapo Yetze, if he comes in alone, he goes out alone. We do learn an additional factor. What does it mean he goes out alone? I asked that question before, because it seems to be pretty self-evident. If you come in alone, you go out alone. What do you mean? So Rashi says, again, indirectly it's teaching us that if he came in alone, he is not given a wife. So this law, that the master has the right to give him a wife, applies only in a specific situation. Well, first of all, let me introduce another fact at this point in time. This idea of giving over the wife applies only to an Eved Ivri who became an Eved because he was sold for robbery which can't be paid back. That's interesting. However, if he's sold himself because of poverty, then this law of giving a wife does not apply. That's one thing. The Rambam in Hilchos Avodim says that one who was sold by the Beis Din, and you know that means he stole, okay, not one who sold himself. So the owner has permission to give him a Shifcha Kenanis, a female slave, Gentile slave. Whether it be both the master and both the son of the master, if his father died. So that's something else. We're not really interested in that point right now, but if the master who purchased him, if he died during the course of the tenure, so the son assumes the role of the master. He can give him, and he too has the right, not just the original owner, but even the son has the right to give him the shifcha. And he can force him on this, coerce him. So the Eved does not have the right to veto it. Why? Kadesha Yolad Mimena Avadim, in order to sire from her slaves. He can increase the slaves. And she is permitted to him all the days of his avdus. What's interesting? It's interesting. It's not. Oh, it's not. It's more than that. It is a wife, because it does say Oisha Viladeh, the wife. She does become somewhat of a wife. So it's more than just mating together to have a child, and that's it. Because he says she's mutter to him, so she becomes a wife, and he can have relations with her, even aside from pregnancy. For example, let's say she becomes pregnant. Does that mean that he can no longer have relations? And we're looking at it on a level where it does seem to be partake a little bit of an animalistic thing, where you side, you know, with horses, for example, they'll mate them, but just to have them, you know, to reproduce, to have a child. A child. A baby horse. But then, that's it. The mating season is over, because that's the only purpose. Here, it's not done that way. It looks a little bit like that, but it's not, that's the purpose. The purpose is to produce avadim. But the Rambam is saying that she's mutter to him all the days of his avdus. For it says, if his master gives him an isha, gives him a woman, which does mean to say that it does partake of a marriage. So it's a marriage phenomenon. So just to summarize what we've said, the master has the right to give to him a Gentile slave for the sake of having a children. And it would seem that this could be done against his will. Take a look at the Rashi, Begapo Yetze, where Rashi said, it's in brackets, but I think we should include it, where he says that the if he's not married, this is another factor, this is an important factor. There's two conditions that apply. So it's not in every case. First of all, it's not in the case where he sold himself out of poverty and became an eved. In that case, he can't give him the shifcha. So of course, we have to understand why. What's the difference? It's only in the case where Bezdin sold him because he stole and can't pay back. There's another condition, though. Even in the case where he stole and can't pay back, which is he'd be eligible, but that's only if he came in married. If he's already has one wife, if he's already married. However, if he came in unmarried, then he goes out unmarried, means that he can't obtain a wife during the course of his avdus. In that case, he cannot give him a wife. That's what he says. Ein rabba mos lo shifcha kananis al karcho. His master cannot give him a wife against his will. The Rambam, of course, says clearly that he coerces him. Now, the Rambam doesn't go into an explanation of the extent of the coercion and what he does to force him into doing this kind of a thing. It's not clear what the extent of the coercion is. It just means to say that he can't reject it. Like, the legitimate activities of being an Eved, the Eved has to do. Otherwise, he's in violation. So, with regard to the legitimate activities, whatever service, whatever work he does for him, so they're not up to, he doesn't have to get permission from the Eved, he tells the Eved what he's to do. Of course, he's prohibited from forcing him to do very harsh labor. That's something else, that he can't do. That's outside the permission of the master. The master doesn't have the right to do that. But within the framework of acceptable work, the Eved can't say, I'm going to sleep. He's got to do the work so that he can coerce him to do it. Well, it's a separate question. What are the legitimate measures of coercion that he may employ and what may he not employ? But we're not taking that up right now. What the Rambam is telling us is that this is a legitimate requirement, that the master has the right to impose this on him and to coerce him to do that to the same extent as he can coerce any other activity. That is to say, the Eved does not have a right of refusal with regard to this. There are a number of questions that we need to ask about this. The main question would seem to be, why? When I say why, I'm recognizing that what the Torah is doing over here is really removing what otherwise would be a very serious prohibition. The term is isser. This is a serious isser. To have relations, or to be even to be involved in some kind of a marriage with a Gentile woman. And this is a Gentile woman. She's a shifcha. So, what comes out over here is that, never mind the idea that the master imposes a situation, a marriage upon him, we'll deal with that, whether that's something that is problematical or not, an enforced kind of a marriage. But from a halachic standpoint, that's the problem. That the Torah is creating a heter. It's going out of its way. Because in the normal course of events, this would be prohibited. And in the case where he's already, if he doesn't have a wife, he can't give, cannot have the shivcha. It's prohibited. And in the case where he sold himself because of poverty, can't have it. It's prohibited. So what the Torah came along was it created a special matir, went out of its way to remove the prohibition against something which otherwise would be off limits, and not just a minor prohibition, it's a very serious prohibition. So that makes it even stronger. Why did the Torah go out of its way to remove that prohibition? The other questions would be, but if that is the case, for whatever reason, which we don't know at this point, hopefully we'll discover that the Torah saw fit that he should have this woman as a wife temporarily and have children, why is it only in that situation where A, he became an Eved because he was sold as a result of slavery, and even within that framework, that's only if he already is married. But if he's single and not married, then we don't commit it. If anything, you would think just the opposite. Most people's reactions would be to the contrary. If he's already married, so why are you doing this? That makes it worse for people to take. And we're going by the emotions of the moment. That's the contemporary society. We're going to sort of take up an issue now that is in relation to this whole question, which is disturbing certain people. Now, what's disturbing when you study something in the Torah can be disturbing purely on intellectual grounds, because you're trying to unravel and figure things out, or trying to make sense out of something, but sometimes it can evoke a certain emotion. There's something you read about in the Torah which can evoke a certain emotion. And on the emotional level, it can be distasteful to you. And this is the reaction that we're having over here. That many of the women are having a problem accepting the idea that the Torah would permit a Jew who's married to a Jewish woman, would, the whole idea, the whole concept of the master giving him a wife on an emotional level is challenging, or it's difficult to accept. For a number of reasons. And of course, you have to understand it from the woman's point of view as well. But simply, the notion that the master can exercise control over this area. This seems to be an area that's different than ordinary kind of work. It's one thing to do work which is legitimate. It's not something which is offensive to his dignity. Or it's not backbreaking work, so it's work. There's nothing wrong with doing work, and within certain parameters, the master has the right to coerce him to do the work. That's what he was purchased for. That concept we can understand. But this seems to be completely out of left field. It's another idea if a master has possessions like animals, and he wants them to reproduce, he wants to increase his possessions, it's one thing. But now you're talking in the human realm. So it would be a difficult idea to accept in general, but specifically with a Jew, the idea that he gives him a wife. Meaning to say it's not someone that the person has chosen of his own accord. It's a coerced kind of a marriage, and I'd say it's a different kind of a marriage. Because she's only a wife for the sake of having the children, essentially. Although it seems that once he does marry her, she's permitted to him. That is, he's not restricted only to having children. So he can have relations with her.
But it seems to be something that goes contrary to people's notions that this area is private and that this area should be associated with love. That's, I think, one of the factors that bothers people. One of the girls mentioned that it appears to her to be something which is disgusting, to force someone to have sex with someone that he really doesn't choose. Now, many of these ideas affect a person because of the culture that we live in, seems to me. It's all right. I mean, everybody lives in a certain culture, and everybody imbibes certain ideas from those cultures. However, you have to be able to differentiate. Just because you feel a certain way about something doesn't mean that this is really true, or it doesn't mean that this is the Torah's philosophy, it's the Torah's outlook. So we'll try and work through those issues, because I think it's something very significant that we may have stumbled upon, that in studying this area, the institution of Eved Ivri, specifically with regard to the idea that he could take a shivcha, or the master gives him a shivcha, it's not something that he takes. It's not like he has the choice, because it's not his shivcha. So it's something the master has the option to do. And the Eved seems to be simply passive in that regard. He can't resist. Would seem to me to be a window which would open up a greater understanding of the Torah's attitude towards sexuality, and I think it'll be different than what we imagine it to be. It's being mentioned that we have some kind of a precedent, because we've read about the Imahos, the mothers. Sarah couldn't have a child, and she gave her servant, Hagar, to Abraham as a wife for the purpose of having children. That perhaps is similar. That too opens up a window. But yet nobody, when you read about that, you don't have that same reaction. Nobody finds that distasteful. The same thing, of course, happened later on with Leah giving Zilpah and Rachel giving Bilhah, their maids, to Yaakov, purely for the sake of having children. And yet we read about that and nobody raises the question. So what's the difference? There are a number of issues pertaining to the Eved Ivri. One is just the way the whole issue of sex is being handled, aside from the fact that he's already married, and what about the feelings of the wife, aside from that. Then there's the issue of the wife. That's something that bothers people also, that it is imposing some type of a burden, a mental burden on the wife, knowing that there's another woman that's going to be sleeping with her husband. I think that figures very prominently into what's bothering people when they read this. Now, in the case of the Imahos, we can differentiate, I think, the distinction that's being made, that was voluntary. In fact, it originated with Sarah, with her idea, with her suggestion, and not Abraham's idea. Would indicate, perhaps, that Abraham would not have asked to do something like that, because he recognized that would be a difficult thing for Sarah. That is the case. There is a certain kind of a rivalry. No question about it. Insofar as that issue is concerned, the idea of competition and jealousy, I think the answer is good. Since it stemmed from the wife herself, that was her greatness, in fact. That's an indication of the greatness, that she was sacrificing something personal. Her exclusive relationship with Avraham, let us say, she was sacrificing that and taking in another woman who would be a competitor just for the sake of having a child. But that, you really can't ask a question, because who the one to make the decision was Sarah. Sarah made the decision, nothing was imposed upon her, and if that was her standard, if she was content with that, so that's a very high level of nobility, the sake of the cause rather than her personal emotions, so that's not a problem. In this situation, however, the idea does not stem, it doesn't originate either with the husband or with the wife. It's something which the master imposes on the Eved. So the question, there's two angles to the question. One angle is in terms of the Eved himself. It seems to be the meaning that this area, which is associated with the person's own emotional satisfaction and fulfillment, is being tread upon, being compromised. That's the first issue. Then, of course, you could say, and also, ironically, it's only in a case where he already has a wife. Yeah, but doesn't that create a problem in terms of the wife's feelings? There's going to be a certain amount of envy or jealousy. In other words, we're saying, is there not an injustice being done to the wife, which seems to be a greater injustice than the one to the husband? If indeed there is an injustice. It seems that the question is really saying it's not even fair to the man because you're forcing him to have sex with someone that he may not want to have sex with. That's one question. The second issue has to do with the effect that this is having on the wife. It's interesting to note that we do see in the case of marrying two sisters, it says litzror, that it's prohibited to marry the sister, to divorce a woman and marry her sister while your first wife while she's still alive. Litzror, because that's going to create a situation where two sisters are now going to be competitors, even though one was divorced. We analyzed that at one point, but psychologically it's a sore point. Because she had a relationship with this man, and now her sister, is there's going to be an envious factor that's brought into the picture, which is greater. As a stranger is a different story. So of course you can always marry a stranger. These two women are not connected, but the sister with whom she has an ongoing relationship, and there is a certain envy. So the fact that the sister now living happily with the husband that didn't work out with her is going to create a problem. We have touched upon this type of an issue as to whether there's something holy, so to speak, something sacred about a person's sexual experience. That's something that is very, very personal, and it's very special, and it's very unique, and to merely use it, not where it does not really produce a certain type of a satisfaction and a pleasantness. As, for example, we've discussed it in the case of Lot offering his daughters to the strangers. And we said that Lot did not have any principles when it came to sex, sexual morality. He thought that essentially whatever a person enjoys, a very modern philosophy, whatever a person enjoys doing, that's appropriate. There's nothing wrong. And we mentioned that even though Judaism disagrees, because we maintain that there has to be certain boundaries within the realm of the sexual. However, we said that he was consistent in his own framework, that he believed that the essence of a person's perfection has to do with compassion to others. And if compassion to others means to satisfy another person's sexual needs, even in a situation where you don't derive any pleasure from it, then you shouldn't withhold. If you do withhold, then there's a defect in terms of your capacity for compassion. So my challenge would be today, today that's the morality of the day. Many people maintain that there's no such thing as an objectively correct or incorrect activity, morality, when it comes to the sexual. Whatever pleases you, it's all subjective. So homosexuality, lesbianism, and so on and so forth. I don't know if there's any limits whatsoever. It's whatever makes you happy. Okay, if that's the case, and they also maintain, of course, that the only thing that really matters in terms of any kind of morality is doing good things for others, helping those in need. So if we were to suggest that these people should go to prisons, let us say, where the prisoners cannot have their sexual needs gratified and they're in pain, and they should just offer their bodies for this, even though they derive no pleasure whatsoever, and they may find that it is slightly repulsive, I think many people would reject it and say, that I can't give, because that's a sexual thing. There's a certain sacredness that they attach to it. The idea is very difficult for them. It's not just the unpleasantness of the thing itself. Bear that in mind. There are many things that people do that are unpleasant. For example, very often you get stuck somewhere and you have to stay in this rinky-dinky, broken-down hotel, you know, and maybe where it's dirty or repulsive and so forth. But people will do it for a cause. There are people that will do that for a cause if they have to. To say that you have to go somewhere and raise money for someone or help someone, and the accommodations are going to be really, really abysmal. most people will be willing to do that if they really are dedicated. And they can understand, because the fact that they went into a night and it was very uncomfortable, or they didn't have hot and cold running water, they couldn't take a decent shower for 3 days, whatever it is, that's something they can endure. That's just a question of pain, but that pain doesn't have any emotional connotation attached to it. But the idea of getting to bed with someone that you're not attracted to, and the whole thing could be 5 or 10 minutes, whatever the case is, they look at it differently. That, because that's an affront to their sense of self, to their whole idea of what's important in life, to their fulfillment in life. That's a breach in something which they regard as being very special. So there are people that might take a utilitarian attitude. That's the whole basis of prostitution. People look down on that. It's the whole question. I don't understand what the people who subscribe to the contemporary view that it's perfectly fine to have sex in the context of a relationship, you don't have to have marriage, and you can have multiple partners, whatever the case may be, but they would look down on prostitution. And what's the difference? A prostitute has her criteria. She gets money for it. So what's wrong? Well, you're selling your body. All these things that people say, they just don't resonate. I don't see, so what? What's the difference? According to your morality, I'm saying, not according to Torah morality. I'm saying there's a lack of consistency, because once you say that from a moral standpoint, there's nothing wrong with the act itself. Unless they want to say that there is, and the only thing that makes an act of sex permitted would be the fact that there's some meaning between the two. But where does that come from? That's your own idea that you're imposing. How can you impose that as an objective thing? It doesn't make sense to me, because what about people that get involved in consensually, in a consensual relationship, and it's purely for the sex per se? There's no real emotional connection between them. There are people like that, and nobody, the only ones that would criticize that would be people that are coming at it from the standpoint of Torah or some moral code. But if you don't have the moral code, so then fine, that's their choice. It's consensual. Question is, what's the Torah's attitude? Is the Torah in any way, shape, or form taking up this attitude? That is to say, that there is something special and beautiful and unique and personal and private, and you just can't tamper with that kind of thing. Is that the attitude of the Torah? Judaism says that you can't have sex whenever you want, that there's the forbidden and there's the prohibited, that there's a need to keep it under certain restraints. And one of those restraints, of course, is marriage. But to say that you just can't have sex with anyone that you want, and you have to have a restraint, is not necessarily the same idea as saying that it's because it's something sacred and personal and wonderful and has to be associated with love and so on and so forth. That is not necessarily the same thing. I mean, does a person have to marry because of love?
No,
if that's the case, can a person marry someone that he doesn't love? I'll up the ante,
yeah.
I'll raise the stakes, and I'll ask the question, according to Judaism, are you permitted to marry for money? This, of course, another way of raising the question is it permitted for a man to marry, or appropriate, permitted is not the correct term, to marry a woman for other considerations, for money considerations, or for any other practical considerations, or must you marry? When I say must, it's not the law, but I mean, would it be the correct thing? The correct philosophy is that you really should marry for love, or you have to marry for love, or you're supposed to marry for love. The way I would put it is, in a certain sense, there is an ideal of love. Reyim ha'ahuvim, it's mentioned in the blessings, the seven brachos that are recited in the chuppah. All the idea, sameach v'samach reyim ha'ahuvim, beloved friends. That is, there is an element of love. However, I would say it's completely different than the concept that we think about in terms of contemporary American society, or the world in general, throughout all of history, which is an emotionalistic type of a thing. It's a fantasy that two people just find each other, and that becomes the essence, that just by merely finding each other and being with each other, that transcends everything, and love per se puts you in a certain state of bliss. That's, I think, what people think about. In Judaism, the idea of love would be a different one. It would be more in line with the general idea of the Ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha. You shall love your friend as yourself. It's not identical to that, because that's not talking about an emotional relationship. That just means to say, have the regard that you have. You have to regard every fellow human being, every fellow Jew, as created in the image of God, with this the same rights, the same dignity, the same entitlement in terms of respect that you would accord to yourself. Of course, that's not what we're talking about when you're talking about marrying someone. That's a personal... Here you have the element of a personal relationship. But it seems to me that there too, it has to do with a person's recognition of the good. And people, the only people, in my opinion, that can experience this type of love, it's where it's... You don't love the person for the person, for the sake of the person inherently, but it's because of the values that this person reflects. That is, that when a person is, his whole life is directed towards a certain goal, towards certain good, virtues, and ideals, and then you find another person with whom you can share those ideals, and that person reflects these values of justice, for example. That's why I always mention the most important element is justice and truth. You're dealing with a person who respects truth and injustice. And of course there's the no question that there has to be the personal. The personal has to be there. But the personal just is a means to an end. It enables you to get along with the other person on an emotional level, but that's not what constitutes the... Just because you can get along with someone doesn't mean that there's love. Love is of the person. And it's because this person is very much tied up with the ultimate ideals and values that you have in your life. And then the living the life, living that life together and sharing those things with the person is what, that I think is what I would call a type of love which is legitimate, which is based upon a real ideal. That's something which is achievable. It's easier, much easier to achieve than the romantic notion of love, which I think is very difficult. And it's not long-lasting. It fades away rather quickly. This is something that can be worked on. It implies a completely different approach, of course. It's a different orientation in terms of searching for the right person as opposed to just being complete. As opposed to being completely under the influence of certain emotions. That is, you can tell the reaction when you try to set somebody up and they go out. And yeah, well, they're a very nice person. I really enjoy talking to them, but... Well, the chemistry factor. Now, I'm not saying you can ignore all these things. I'm merely saying that sometimes it reflects an attitude that the person just waiting for a certain reaction. When they feel a certain type of reaction that they've been trained since youth to be looking for, then that's the person. But the idea that you could develop feelings of love by getting to know the person, that love which stems from the fact that you got to know the person and really like the person, like is a better word than love. That's, in my opinion, if a person were to take that attitude, would be a much happier situation. Indeed, it's very interesting to note that many people who got divorced, which is, I guess, is 50% today, in their second marriage, because they've learned from the experiences, have found happiness, found a great happiness, because now they're looking for the person. They're interested in the person, not the fantasy. And I speak to a number of these people, and they say, yeah, the first time around, they could never have married this kind of a person, because that's not what they were looking for. Erroneously, they were searching for something else, but after the suffering and the disappointment, they discovered what's really important and looked for someone that has the qualities that are really important, not the fantasy qualities. It seems to me that the sexual question that we've raised, and we said that today, people view it as being something sacred, and it's very personal, and the idea of engaging in it in a situation where you don't get profound emotional gratification, that idea is troubling. The idea that there is something sacred about the sexual, that a person should only engage in it, not just where it's morally appropriate, but also where it provides a person with a certain type of fulfillment, it seems to me that is not the ideal of Judaism. Such that you could isolate that point and say that in the case of an Eved Ivri, engaging in the sexual act where there's no real emotion of love, and indeed, it's not even a real marriage because it's only a temporary marriage. So that you would say that there's something wrong with that, I disagree. The Torah does not, in my opinion, advocate the same attitude towards the sexual. Quite the contrary. Quite the contrary. The basic philosophy of the Torah with regard to the sexual would be the same as with regard to all of the instinctual desires or needs. Essentially, that a person should satisfy them in moderation. There should be controls. And a person should seek to sublimate the energy. Now, when it comes to the sexual, first and foremost, it's to be associated with procreation. That the purpose, if a person were to maintain that the purpose of the sexual is to be a source of providing pleasure, that's why God created it, that's false. That's a mistake. It was, to the contrary, the essential purpose of the sexual is for the sake of procreation. Except God designed it in such a way that it would be associated with certain processes in the person that will be pleasurable. But that's secondary. That's not the underlying cause. That's the mistake that everybody makes. In the same way, the purpose of eating is not pleasure. The purpose of eating is the health, nutrition of the body. But God designed it in such a way that there's a byproduct. It does provide a certain enjoyment. But for a person to corrupt the situation and take that byproduct and say that's the whole objective, and make that into a pursuit, an end in itself, that's hedonism and it's denial of Torah. The same is true with the sexual. To say that pleasure, that's what's wrong with homosexuality. The deviance, because that's separating the element of the pleasure and saying that's the essence, that's an end in itself, to pursue that kind of pleasure in a situation where it's completely cut off from any possibility of procreation. That's why the Torah is completely opposed to that. Therefore, if a person has that attitude, they don't look upon the sex, they don't identify. There's this element of identification, that a person identifies their self. Their whole sense of self has to do with the sensual, with the physical aspect, with the body, with how they look, and that's part of the tattooing idea, whatever. That's their essence, and that means their sexual is their essence. That's part of it. And therefore, in my opinion, that's a person that's living according to the philosophy of Torah does not look at the sexual any differently than they would look at any other bodily need or bodily activity. They may look at it differently in the sense of the recognition that this is something that could be a source of corruption. They'd be very careful and distance themselves. As the Rambam says in the Mor Nevuchim, that one of the objectives of the Torah is to cause us to distance ourselves from the sexual. To diminish. All of this to diminish. Of course, a person has to be careful. And recognize that they have psychological needs, and if that doesn't mean that they should repress themselves and be in a state of pain. But we don't idealize the sexual. That is for sure. The Rambam has a whole chapter in the Mor Nevuchim in which he speaks about this at length. That the perfected individual looks at the very necessity of engaging in sexual relations as a burden, as a chore, as something which is shameful. Not shameful on a psychological level, but in the sense that when you recognize, I tried to illustrate this point. That is, most people have the exact opposite attitude. They look at the sex, they may be frustrated in their lives in terms of sexual fulfillment, that's something else, but the general attitude is that this is something positive. And they would have a sense of pity if somebody gets older or whatever, or someone has an illness and they completely lose any sexual desire. Some of those people would have pity on them because they can't identify with a situation like that. So most people would look at that as being a terrible evil if you were to lose your sexual desire. Even people that are basically frustrated in their life because they still have the fantasy that at a certain point they'll have sexual satisfaction. The Rambam talks about something else. He talks about developing an attitude of shame. Perfected person is ashamed. Now, it's very difficult to understand why would you be ashamed? That's how God designed you. So I think he's talking about a philosophical idea. That is to say that the average individual looks looks favorably upon the fact that they're a sexual creature. That's something which is good about life, which is, they're happy about that. Because they associate that as being a great gift. Why is it a great gift? Because it's associated with that fantasy of tremendous satisfaction. But that's a very serious mistake as far as Yahadus is concerned. A person should not have that attitude. Now, I'm not saying not, I don't mean to make anybody feel guilty. I understand that that's just going to be there until you reach a certain point in life when you start to separate yourself from that and you really see that it's not the good that you thought it was. A person that has their energy involved in the world of knowledge and learning and that pleasure begins to look at all of their physical needs in a completely different light. They don't look at them as being pleasures. It's a burden. It's something that's a drain. It takes you away from the good. They recognize that. They recognize to the extent that they're caught up in these emotional needs, and if they can't satisfy it, they'll be in pain, and to the extent that it creates certain fantasies, it takes them away from the good. In much the same way that if a person has a certain skill or a talent, whether it be in athletics or whether it be in art or anything, and there are certain things that could be harmful, certain the environment or a certain type of situation can weaken them. For example, let's say they have a certain skill, and because of this, it wouldn't be helpful to drink wine. Wine would be dangerous. I'm just making up something, anything. So they're going to have a certain attitude towards wine. They want to keep a certain distance because they see it as interfering with their ability to be involved in something which is very, very significant and pleasurable. Now, most people don't look at the sexual that way because that's their whole world. The whole world is the world of fantasy and romance, and the sexual plays a very significant place in it. But a person that was completely involved in creating something significant from the intellectual standpoint and recognize what a diversion this is, and when they're involved in these kinds of things, for example, a better example perhaps would be drugs. That a person was a great athlete, then for whatever reason they were seduced into trying out drugs and they got hooked on drugs, and now then they can't perform athletically, and then somehow or other they get cured and they go back to the athletics. What's going to be their attitude towards drugs? They're going to despise it. It's going to be something that they despise, that they frown upon, because they really see what an evil it is. But it's only an evil for those people that perceive how it takes them away from the good, from what they regard as the good. So a perfected individual who really sees that the essence of what life is all about and what he is, it really has to do with knowledge and ideas, then he begins to look at the whole physical as being a negative, a liability. It's a burden that he has to carry around. Cannot look at it in a positive way. What does it contribute positively to his existence? Oh, most people, that's the essence of their existence, because they're only involved in the world of emotional pleasure, emotional pain. So that's, even in spite of the fact that it does cause a tremendous amount of pain and searching for someone and fantasizing and all of that, but nevertheless, since that's the only concept of pleasure and the good that they have, that's their attitude. There's the idealization of the sexual. That, I think, is the source of this idea that we've been talking about. That the notion of coercing an Eved into having a sexual relationship with someone that's not of his choosing, and someone that might not provide him with any kind of pleasure, he might not enjoy it, that's a terrible thing. That's not part of the attitude of Yahadus, because this wasn't created for pleasure. Now, of course, in practical terms, the master should be kind, should not afflict the Eved, and if it's clear that, for whatever reason, this woman he wants to give are so repulsive to him that it would cause him a lot of pain, that's a separate factor. We're not talking about that. So then the master is not supposed to expose him to pain and suffering. That's a different case. But we're just talking about, it's not the case like that. It's an ordinary person to whom he's not attracted, but it's not repulsive either. Not repulsive either to him. So that's just an issue that he's going to be having sexual relations with someone not of his choosing, and not in a context where it's going to be satisfying any of these emotional and romantic fantasies and desires. Is there something wrong with that? Has the master impinged upon his rights? Or that which is sacred to him, according to the analysis that I've just given, the answer is no. We're assuming a normal individual. What's the problem? Why should he ever object to doing that any more than he would object to doing any other kind of work? The only question that any normal individual who lives in accordance with Torah would have when such a suggestion is made, that he should have sex with a certain individual for a given purpose, a mundane purpose, practical purpose, is it permitted or prohibited according to the Torah? Is it mutter or is it also? That's the only question. Oh, so you do have to check the halachic. And generally speaking, as we said, the shivcha, the Gentile woman, is prohibited. However, the master says in this situation, the Torah has permitted it. So there's no prohibition. This woman is permitted to you. What is the motivating factor behind your relationship with her? The fact that you have an obligation to serve the master because you are being punished for the crime that you committed of the theft. So now you have to be my servant. You've been sold by the Bezdin, and you're my servant. And you have to do what the Torah considers to be the legitimate forms of work, which one form, whatever jobs are permitted to be assigned to him, and the other form is to impregnate this woman. Now the master can't impregnate her. This is the right of the master. The right of the master to increase his property in terms of slaves. Because these children will be slaves. They're not going to be Jews. They're going to be belonging to the master. So that's one of his rights that he acquired when he purchased the Yeved, the servant. The master himself cannot have children through her because she's a shiksa and he's not a slave. He's not allowed to have sex with her. But interestingly enough, his Eved can. So that's what I expect of you, to impregnate this woman, produce children for me. Now, from the standpoint of an objection that now you're intruding upon something personal and sacred to me, and that is my sexual experience, I've shown that there's no such thing. There's nothing wrong with it. The only thing that might be wrong with a sexual act would be that it's prohibited by the Torah. But it's not prohibited by the Torah. So a rational individual should not have a problem with it. If this person can't get past it, he's repulsed by the situation, so that's something else. We're not talking about that. So the master, out of kindness and compassion, should not force him to do something which he can't do. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about the possibility of raising a moral objection. What's the moral objection? What's the emotional objection? You shouldn't have an emotional problem with this. To go one step further, the Rambam explains that before the Torah was given, the Torah did permit the institution, I guess, which would be called prostitution. And indeed, today, for someone who is a Noahide is a righteous Gentile that keeps the 7 Noahide laws, such a person who believes in God and Torah and recognizes that these are what God's will for him, such a person is a righteous person and has a share in the world to come. Prostitution is permitted for a Gentile. The Rambam says that before the Torah was given, a person would meet a woman in the street, and if they both desired, consensual, he could pay her whatever her fee was, and take her to his place and have sex with her. That's illustrated in the story of Yehuda and Tamar. Yehuda did not do something which was wrong. Of course, he didn't want people to find out about it because people's tongues are always wagging, but in terms of the breaking of the 7 Noahide laws, he wasn't breaking them. And he was a great man. Well, doesn't that say something? If the Torah permits it, the Torah is saying that the Torah is recognizing, for Jews, now that we have the system, we have Kedushin. We have to operate on a higher level, and it's prohibited. You can't have, in the Jewish people, you can't have Kedusha, you can't have prostitution. Because that's a breach in the Kedusha, in the holiness of Klal Yisrael. But for the Gentiles at large, it's not the case. That is to say that inherently there's nothing wrong with it. What's wrong with it is, of course, if you're living according to a system which is striving to achieve a very high level of kedusha, of holiness. But for people that are on the level of the seven Noahide laws, which is a different level, so that's all right. Why is it all right? Because we don't idealize the sexual instinct. Now, what's so horrifying about prostitution to people? What is so horrifying about it? Why is it prohibited by this society? What's so terrible about it? It seems to me it's only considered terrible because in the back of your mind you've made this into something beautiful and great, and it's interestingly enough, the people that are against prostitution, who theoretically would seem to be people on a higher level, are really on a lower level, because that means you're more steeped in hedonism and false values, and you've elevated the sexual to something very sacred. But people, so therefore, since it's sacred, how can you just have purchase a sexual favor? But if you look at it realistically, and again, not within Jewish society, we're not talking about achieving that level of kedusha, so it's not prohibited by God, then you have a person who's looking at the sexual instinct in a very practical, realistic, utilitarian kind of thing. It's a need that I have, and for whatever reason I can't gratify it in a marriage, whatever the fact is may be. So it's a need that I have, and I can satisfy that instinctual need in a situation where there won't be any commitment, there won't be any love, and there won't be any of the experience of all these other things that people associate to try and idealize the sexual and make it into something which it's not. So what's wrong with that? The Torah is saying it's all right. But the moralist in this society is saying it's not all right because that's a false morality of our society, which is based upon the deification, the idealization of the sensual. Only sensual people are opposed to prostitution. Okay. To further illustrate the idea that, as I was saying, the Torah is not inherently opposed to prostitution, per se, for Gentiles, even though Gentiles are held to a certain standard of behavior. And they are commanded in terms of the Ivarios, forbidden sexual relations. So they are not permitted to live like wanton animals. Jews, of course, are prohibited from prostitution, because as the Rambam says, that's the institution of Kedesha, that a woman whose essentially her whole designation is for prostitution purposes. That's something which exists in a certain society which has a purpose, which is tied in with achieving a very high degree of holiness. However, as we've seen before Matan Torah, before the giving of the Torah, there was no prohibition against a prostitute. Thus we say that the Torah does not find it inherently to be an evil. And this gives us a window, an insight into the Torah's attitude towards the issue of sexuality. Now, in a sense, talking about the woman who is a prostitute, that isn't being a prostitute, this is the question that's being raised, isn't that something terrible, and the woman is immersed in the sexual or the sensual and lust, and what kind of a life can she possibly have? I dispute that. I think that the society we are in is involved in a tremendous contradiction. For on the one hand, it glorifies and permits every form of sexuality with one condition, proviso, so to speak, and that is that it's consensual. But this society sees nothing wrong with individuals having affairs. Even adultery is not considered to be a big deal today, and something which people are not ashamed of. If they're involved in the Hollywood stars, if they're involved in an adulterous relationship, they don't try to hide it. And children are born out of wedlock. So that because it's love, as long as there's love. And homosexual relationships, every kind of relationship is condemned. If that is the case, on what basis can the society be opposed to prostitution? But prostitution, where a woman is getting paid for it, that's where they draw the line. That's horrible. How is that the case? Does that make any sense? That shows that society is steeped in sensualness and sensuality. Because what they're saying is that if the sex is divorced from all of these fantasies, then it somehow is a terrible thing. To the contrary, a woman who is a prostitute, if there's in a sane society where it recognizes that people have sexual needs, and if you're saying it's consensual, that makes it all right. So what's wrong if it's consensual? And the basis of the consent is that you pay the woman a fee. How does that make it prohibited all of a sudden? But here, it's less of the sensual. And it's more related to viewing sex as basically what it is. It's a physical and psychological need. It's an instinctual need. So we're you know, looking at it that way, and you're looking at it as something beautiful and romantic, so then it's wonderful, then it's fine, no matter how repugnant it is. Even if it violates legitimate moral restraints and restrictions that ought to be in place. Adultery, for example. That's an animalistic type of thing. I don't care who's in love with who, it's animalistic. The inability to control the sexual in terms of violating somebody else's marriage. There, it's not a problem. But in a situation of prostitution, where it's being addressed in accordance with the purpose. Now, the purposes of the sexual, the fundamental purpose is procreation. So, of course, prostitution, it's not for procreation, obviously. But on a secondary level, once it exists, it does constitute a legitimate need of a person. That's the way a person is constructed. It's no different. It's a very powerful urge that needs to be gratified. So ideally, it should be gratified in the framework of a marriage. But not everybody is on the level of the ideal. So therefore, what is wrong with the notion that a person has an opportunity, legally and safely, to be able to gratify that need until such time as they can contract a partner and become married? What's so bad about it? I don't understand. Where this society is saying that it's definitely okay to have premarital sex as long as it's with someone that you're in a relationship with. Why the need for a relationship? How does that make it good? How does that sanctify it? Oh, then you must hold that sex is something that should be sanctified. That it's really something very, very meaningful. That it's a meaning, the experience has meaning in and of itself. Now, I know a lot of people believe that. And I wouldn't be surprised that a lot of rabbis and religious Jews believe that too, that there's something mysterious about it. Which is completely contrary. It's not the true teaching of Judaism. There's nothing unique and special and romantic and wonderful and fulfilling about it. That's not the Jewish attitude. It's an example of situations where Jews have been affected and internalized the false values of the society that they live in. As far as the woman, the prostitute, is concerned, she's not steeped in the sensual. She's doing it purely from the standpoint of a business transaction. And I would say that in the overwhelming majority of cases, a prostitute does not get sensual gratification out of what she's doing. So therefore, well, she's not steeped in the sensual. It's a physical activity. She's very cold-blooded, so to speak, about the sex. And to a certain extent, the man is too. The man recognizes that he's not in a romantic situation. He's paying money for it. So that's separating the sexual. That's why people have a difficulty with it. Oh, it's just animalistic. Separating the sexual and making it into a purely instinctual phenomenon, separating it from the whole fantasy of all the romantic emotions that most people associate it with. Well, the Torah doesn't view that as being evil. Of course, as I've said, the reason why the Torah is opposed to homosexuality is because that's an institution where you've totally removed the sexual from the possibility of procreation. But that's when it's with a man. The Torah does not look at heterosexuality, even outside of a procreation situation, in the same way. Women are permitted. So, if that's the case, I think that we've established that the Torah looks at the sexual act in a different light. And in this situation, where, we'll get back to the Eved Ivri now, the Jewish servant, in this situation, it's practical. The master has these women, slaves, these Gentile women, and he wants to increase the number. So he's giving one of them to the Eved. Because he, as I said, he can't have relations with her. Because he's not an Eved, and he's prohibited. But because of the exemption over here in the Torah, the Eved is permitted to have relations with her, so therefore, it's a different kind of a wife. He gives the Shifcha as a wife, he has relations with her, and what's terrible about that? It's connected to the purpose. The purpose here is procreation. It's not the mitzvah of Puravu. That is to say that the Eved would not fulfill the mitzvah of Puravu if he were to have children. Even if it was a boy and a girl, would not fulfill his mitzvah because these children are not Jewish. Fine. But in terms of looking at the sexual from the moral standpoint, what is immoral about this? We're now taking up a different question, and that is that on the surface it would seem that an injustice is being done to an innocent party over here, and that would be the wife. As we've learned, the master is only permitted to give the shivcha in a situation where the eved is already married. So, can it not be asked that this would seem to be unfair to the wife? Because she is going to have to deal with the pain, the emotional distress, of knowing that her husband is with a different woman. And she hasn't sinned. So how would that question be addressed? The answer has to do, in my opinion, with recognizing the nature of this new marriage. In my opinion, the question we have to ask, is there anything wrong over here? Is there any reason for the woman to be jealous? It would seem not, because jealousy would come about where the husband, of his own accord, because of the fact that he's not happy in the marriage, would go out and, so to speak, cheat on his wife, thereby distressing her. This, of course, is not the case over here. This is not something he's doing out of his volition, nor is there anything romantic about this. It's not an emotional relationship. The shivcha is his wife only with respect to the idea that he's permitted to have relations with her. So it's a different kind of a relationship. That is, he's not engaging in a romantic relationship. He's engaging in a sexual activity purely for the sake of having children, and the children will belong to the master. It's not even his children. So on an objective level, there's nothing to be envious of over here. There's no reason for her to be jealous because it does not imply any kind of a rejection of her. Why? Therefore, we would have to ask the person, if she complained, what's bothering you? Do you view this as a rejection? The answer is it's not a rejection. Now, of course, if she has difficulty, she just can't tolerate the thought and so on and so forth, that's not an affliction. Nobody's afflicting her. That's her own personal emotions, and she should be able to adapt to the situation. There are always consequences, by the way. You could ask the question in a different form. According to the American legal system, if a person steals, they're sent to jail. And no one cares about taking care of the wife. No provisions are made to see to it that the wife and the family, and one can raise the question, where's the justice in that? Now the woman is alone. She has nobody to take care of her. She doesn't have a man around the house. She's being punished. What was her crime? All she did was marry the guy. So which situation, which system would you say is more compassionate? The American system, which says, look, we can't help it. We're not doing this to hurt you. We have no choice. We have to punish the criminal. This is an unintended consequence. But it's a consequence that we can't deal with. Halacha says, one second, before we send the person away, we do consider, have we not considered the needs of the wife? Oh, we certainly have. We are effectuating a rehabilitation, if you will, a compensation. He's paying for his crime. And at the same time, the master has assumed the responsibilities that he had towards his wife and children. What a humane and compassionate system that is. That's the reality. Now, other than that, there are other factors that come into the picture. There are certain rights that the master has. The master is providing a service. He's not being shipped off to prison. He's being allowed to stay in society with many benefits, as we've learned. The master has to treat him with all of the benefits and with all of the respect. And he takes care of the wife and children. Well, the master is entitled to certain benefits. And one of those benefits is to increase slaves. That's all it is. There's no objective reason for you to be upset about this. No harm is being done to your marriage. To the contrary, the fact that he has to support the wife, as we've said, is because the Torah wants to retain the marriage. Now, if you don't find this ideal because you have this desire or this feeling that your husband should never ever be with anybody else but you, well, that's just a consequence that you have to deal with. There's such a thing called maturity. You've got to mature. And maturity means to see to it that you're in line with the reality of the situation. Immature is when a person is not behaving appropriate to the situation. We call it immature. A person is throwing a tantrum and going crazy because the waiter brought out the wrong chocolate for dessert and they've been waiting for 10 minutes and so forth, so we say that person's immature. But if a person goes crazy and is emotionally distraught and distressed because they've just heard about a terrible tragedy, they're not immature. That's not immature. That's in line with the reality. So therefore, there's no injustice being done to the wife at all. To the contrary, everything about this institution indicates justice towards the wife and a desire to preserve the marriage in spite of a setback. And we're not blaming you. You married an individual who became a thief, whatever. We're not blaming you, but recognize the reality and then don't get upset about it. That's what we would have to say to this woman. There's one further thing that should be thought of in this regard, which should diminish all of the emotional resistances, problems that the wife might have. When you realize from the start that it's a temporary thing, that 6 years he goes free, that's the norm.
Well, he falls in love with her.
The fact that he chooses to remain is not necessarily because he falls in love with her. The whole situation that he's fallen in love with, which indicates that he's really not quite ready to be a free person, and this is really what's best for him. And if it's best for him, then that's best for her. You don't want to be married to someone who, when you go free, he's going to get himself in trouble again. Obviously this is a more stable situation, but all things being equal, knowing that the marriage is essentially just to have children for the master, and B, that it's temporary, that in and of itself should ease the situation. As far as the question that this permission is granted only if the Eved already has a wife, but if he came into the situation begapo, that is unmarried, then begapo yetze, he goes out in that same state alone, meaning the master cannot give him the shifcha. Now, on the surface, it seems strange, because in the case he's already married, you have the element of the first wife perhaps being upset. We've explained that. We said that she shouldn't be upset. But it would seem to be much simpler in a case where he doesn't have a wife at all. Why, if he does not have a wife, is the master not permitted? The permission is not there. It would seem that the answer has to do with understanding the character of the institution, the design of the institution, the purpose. It has a certain purpose. It has a certain objective. And the objective is not merely so that the money should be raised to pay back the theft. But in its ideal state, it's supposed to be a form of rehabilitation. That this person has a certain defect, a certain weakness, and because of that, he came on hard times, and in order to avoid, he didn't want to become a beggar, which is what I guess he could have done. But his pride did not permit him to just go around begging. Because the truth is that nobody really has to steal in a Jewish society. But he stole. So this is intended to give him the opportunity to, so to speak, get back on his feet, to regroup, to work on his difficulties, and to develop a certain sense of self-confidence in a more secure environment. But the ultimate objective is that he should go free. So you have to balance those two factors. The situation of being a servant with the objective of going free. We don't want to create obstacles to him going free on the seventh year, as we see. We don't want him to re-enlist and become permanent in this state. Therefore, this particular element, you see how finely tuned everything is. The particular element of giving the life, which is deemed to be a necessary thing, as we'll see, cannot be done in a situation where it itself will become the impediment for going free. That is, if he comes in begapo, he's not attached to anyone, so then this shifcha that's given to him can be related to as an emotional attachment. He can look to her to be more than what she was intended to be. A wife simply for having children. No, he can really embrace her and form a very powerful emotional bond with her, and that in and of itself would become the obstacle to going free, because he had nobody to go back to. So he would simply become part of the family of the master. However, if he's already married, if he already has a wife, he's already attached, so then the danger of this woman becoming something more than just a means of having children, the danger of forming that type of an emotional attachment is going to be diminished, because he's involved in the relationship with his wife. So that's why the Torah did not permit it in that situation. There's a balance of factors over here that have to be taken into consideration.